Today's Teisho will be on case 28 in the Mumonkan, the blue in the Mumonkan, the gate of no barrier. Case 28 is entitled Ryutan Blows Out the Candle. Tokusan asked Ryutan about Zen far into the night. At last, Ryutan said, "The night is late. Why don't you retire?" Tokusan made his bows and lifted the blinds to withdraw, but he was met by darkness. Turning back to Ryutan, he said, "It's dark outside." Ryutan lit a paper candle and handed it to him. Tokusan was about to take it when Ryutan blew it out. At this, all of a sudden, Tokusan went through a deep experience and made vows. Ryutan said, "What sort of realization do you have?" "From now on," Tokusan said, "I will not doubt the words of an old priest who is renowned everywhere under the sun." The next day, Ryutan ascended the rostrum and said, "I see a strange fellow among you. His fangs are like the sword tree. His mouth is like a bowl of blood. Strike him with a stick, and he won't even turn his head to look at you. Some day or other, he will climb the highest peaks and establish our way there." Tokusan brought his notes on the Diamond Sutra to the front of the hall, pointed to them with a torch, and said, "Even though you have exhausted all the abstruse doctrines, it is like placing a hair in vast space. Even though you have learned all the secrets of the world, it is like a drop of water dripped on the green ocean." And he burned all his notes. Then, making bows, he took leave of his teacher. Mumon's comment: before Tokusan crossed the barrier from his native place, his mind burned and his mouth uttered bitterness. He went southward, intending to stamp out the doctrine of special transmission outside the sutras. When he reached the road to Ryushu, he asked an old woman to let him have lunch to refresh the mind. "Your worship, what sort of literature do you carry in your pack?" the old woman asked. "Commentaries on the Diamond Sutra," replied Tokusan. The old woman said, "I hear that it is taught in that sutra, the past mind cannot be held, the present mind cannot be held, the future mind cannot be held. Now I would like to ask you, what mind are you going to have refreshed?" At this question, Tokusan was dumbfounded. However, he did not remain inert under her words, but asked, "Do you know of any good teacher around here?" The old woman said, "5 miles from here you will find Priest Ryutan." Coming to Priest Ryutan, Tokusan got the worst of it. His former words were inconsistent with his later ones. As for Ryutan, he seemed to have lost all sense of shame in his compassion towards his son. Finding a bit of live coal in the other, enough to start a fire, he hurriedly poured on muddy water to annihilate everything at once. A little cool reflection tells us it was all a farce. Mumon's verse: hearing the name cannot surpass seeing the face. Seeing the face cannot surpass hearing the name. He may have saved his nose, but alas, he lost his eyes. I want to thank everybody for coming here today. I know that some of you have to drive quite a distance to be here, and it's always a great pleasure to practice with you. I'm glad you made the drive. This is a story about a person who became quite distinguished as a scholar. The person in this story, whose name is Tokusan, was a priest or a monk who was quite distinguished in his time in China for his study of the Diamond Sutra. And he had studied the Diamond Sutra quite carefully for many years. He probably knew the Sanskrit or the Pali in this case it would have been Sanskrit. He probably knew the Sanskrit original. He knew various Chinese translations. He had talked to great scholars and was quite familiar with the whole Buddhist canon. And so he was very learned and accomplished and quite widely respected. And he was a lecturer, like a distinguished lecturer. People would bring him to monasteries and Buddhist teaching centers, and he would lecture on the Diamond Sutra. In fact, he was so distinguished as a scholar on the Diamond Sutra that he became known as Diamond Shu. So he's the main character in the story. And he has the life of a busy and successful person. He goes to this temple and that temple. Maybe he has a secretary who has to keep his calendar, and he has many responsibilities in the Buddhist community. He's given his life to study these sutras. So he's the kind of person who might get up in the morning and take out his Sanskrit, Mandarin dictionary, and start going through the Diamond Sutra, exploring various angles of the text. Very hardworking man, person of great integrity. And he's put in years and years and years of his life studying this book, which is really quite important to Buddhist tradition. If you ever have the time to read the Diamond Sutra, it's really a wonderful, very puzzling in some ways, book, but really quite exciting. So anyway, Diamond Shu is sort of like at the height of his career, and he's giving a lecture, and maybe he's explaining to somebody how properly to understand a certain line in the Diamond Sutra. And after his talk, somebody comes up to him and says, "You know, there is a sect of Buddhism here in China. There's a group of people who say that it's not necessary to read the sutras, and that reading the sutras doesn't make you enlightened, and that basically ideas themselves can't make you enlightened, no matter how good they are." And when Diamond Shu hears this, he's very troubled. You know, he's a typical scholar. You know, he believes that it's important to translate each line correctly, to get the author's meaning correct, and to make sure that there's no mistakes in translation or mistakes in explaining what a passage means. He's very very concerned. You know, people who are good scholars, and I must say I'm very mediocre, but people who are really good, you know, they can become really painstaking. They want everything correct, and there's nothing wrong with this. You know, this is what scholars are supposed to do. So anyway, Diamond Shu gives this lecture, and somebody comes up and says, "You know, basically, there's a sect of people, they say they practice Zen or Chan, and they don't really believe that studying the sutras does any good at all." And he hears this, and he becomes very upset. And he says, "Look, you know, Buddhism is based upon sutras. You know, we study the sutras. These are the teachings of the Buddha. And they were left for us to study so that we can follow his path." And Diamond Shu is very disturbed by this teaching, very disturbed. You know, this is clearly a group of like heretics who are leading people astray and undermining Buddhism in China at a crucial moment. So he decides he's going to find these people, and he's going to debate them. And his mind is so sharp, he's so intelligent, he's sure he can, when he encounters them, he can just crush them in debate. And he has the best motives. You know, He wants to protect the truth. You know, he wants to protect the truth. And he sees his beliefs as true, you know. So anyway, he sets off on a journey to find these people. He finds out where the center of Zen is at this time. And he decides he's going to go there, and he's going to find these evil Zen people, and he's going to demolish their vicious teachings. He sets off with his traveler's equipment. In these days, there were no trains or cars. You pretty much had to walk. So he has a basket on his back, and it contains many of the translations he's made of the Diamond Sutra and his notes. It's like a little library on his back. And he sets out to find the Zen people, and he walks for many, many, many days. You know, this is the old times. You know, in Japan and in China, actually, when people were going to Sesshin, they used to have to first walk to Sesshin, right? So priests, monks and nuns would have to walk to their home temple for Sesshin. It might be a journey of many days. If you'd walk for 2 weeks, and then you'd get to Sesshin and do Sesshin. So this Diamond Shoe sets off across China, and he walks for many, many weeks, really. And as he's walking, he's thinking about these teachings of the Diamond Sutra and how important they are. And he's thinking about how he's going to crush his opponents, the Zen people. He reaches a place which is close to where the Zen people are, but he gets very tired, and he decides he's going to stay at an inn, like a hotel. And he goes into an inn, the restaurant of the hotel, you could say, the eating area of the inn. And there's an old woman there, and she is not a usual old woman. Sometimes in these Zen koans, there's an old woman. They appear in some of these Zen stories, and you have to watch out for them, because they're really symbolic, you could say, of part of our minds we usually overlook. You know, this is an old woman who's apparently unexceptional, running like a hotel restaurant. And Diamond Shoe is this very learned scholar, and he comes in and he sits down and he says, "I would like some." He uses the Chinese word for a snack, basically. "I'd like a snack," and the Chinese word for snack is, I won't pronounce it even close to correctly, but it's tian xin, and it's mind refreshment. He comes in and he says, "I want some mind refreshment." And anybody in China would have understood he's talking about a snack, but literally it means something to refresh my mind. And when she hears this, she says to him, "I hear it is said in the Diamond Sutra, the past mind cannot be held, the present mind cannot be held, the future mind cannot be held. Now I ask you, which mind are you going to have refreshed?" Now, when Diamond Sutra hears this, when Diamond Shoe hears this, he's really shocked, because this woman has a depth of insight he didn't expect from somebody, from a waitress, basically. But not only that, she asked him a question he doesn't know how to answer, because he's been studying these sutras for 40 years, let's say, and he thinks of himself as the master of the sutra, and she points to something he doesn't really understand, and that is that he doesn't really know what the mind is at all, even though he's been studying it all these years. See? And he is stunned. He suddenly realizes, "I don't really know what I've been talking about all these years. I don't know what the mind is, you know. And he's really humbled by this. He's dumbfounded, it says. But he says, "Do you know of any good teacher around here who could help me answer this question of what the mind is?" You know? And an old woman said, 5 miles from here, you will find priest Ryotan. So Tokusan goes to the temple of Ryotan, and it turns out Ryotan is one of the leaders, one of the ringleaders of the Zen sect, the sect that says it's really not necessary to study the sutras. And basically he starts to study with Ryotan. Diamond Shu becomes a student of Ryotan, and he studies for many, many years with Ryotan. And it's not a comfortable relationship, you know? Basically, Diamond Shu's very invested in his study of the sutras. He's very attached to knowledge and to reason and to conscious awareness, you know? And when he goes to see the old teacher at that temple, you know, they go into the Dokusan room and they take a long time because they sort of like argue, you know, or they debate. And one time, Tokusan goes in to see the teacher and they have their usual sort of debate. And it goes on and on and on. And finally, it's nighttime. And Tokusan's about to go, and he notices that it's dark, and says it's dark out there. And so the teacher hands him a candle, puts it in his hand, and lights it. But then, you know, as Tokusan is about to take the candle and go out, the old monk blows the candle out, and everything is dark and blank. And at that moment, Tokusan has an awakening experience. And this is really transformative. And the next day, he goes out and he burns all of his commentaries on the sutras, which is like his life's work. Okay. So that's basically the story. Now, if you're working on a dissertation or a paper article, please don't burn it, okay? It's not necessary. Paper for your class or for publication. This koan is not about destroying your life's work or something like that. It's not about giving up everything and living in a cave or something like that. It's about the mind, right? This is a koan about the mind. And we have a very, we're a lot like a Diamond Shu. You know, we have a very artificial view of the mind, very shallow and erroneous view of the mind. You know, normally people live in a little area. Like, it's like we live in this very small circle, which is ordinary consciousness, we could say. You know, so, you know, when you get up in the morning, you're thinking already, probably. You're thinking, oh boy, that was a good sleep. You know, now what's for breakfast? And you go downstairs and you look for something for breakfast, and maybe you like coffee, and you find you still have some Starbucks coffee in the refrigerator, and then you look and see if you have any eggs, because eggs would be good, and then you think maybe some cheese on the eggs would be good. And you sit down and you read the paper, and then maybe you have to go to work, you have to go to school, and you go to school and you take notes, and you come home, and maybe you watch a little TV, or you study, you go to bed. And, you know, basically, that could be life, right? You know, that's And in that realm, you know, life is a matter of making decisions, evaluating situations, making decisions, and then acting on the basis of your decisions. You know, so you might decide you want to be a doctor. So, you know, when you come to Rutgers, you take chemistry and biology, and you probably have to take a physics course, and of course you're taking calculus. You know, and these courses are difficult. You have to really study hard, and you might be frightened before the test. You sit down and you have to take the test, but you study your best, you answer the questions, you go and get your grade, and maybe it's a 89, so that's okay, you know. And so you study a little harder, and you get up to a 94. That kind of thing is quite familiar, right? It's really the mind that picks and chooses, right? It plans, it picks and chooses, it has likes and dislikes. It thinks, you know, it writes paragraphs, and the paragraphs have to make sense, and they have to have a topic sentence and a consistent thread and so on. This is like the world of consciousness, right? And in the modern world, you know, this is sort of the only, you know, very much this is like the only world that we know about, you know. It's where we live our lives, pretty much, in this very small circle of consciousness, you know, the conscious mind, or we say in Zen, the discriminating mind. And this mind can be really wonderful. You know, I know people who are really brilliant people, and their minds are capable of astonishing feats. You know, they can hold in their minds many, many different ideas, and they can use those ideas in very creative ways. You know, they're quite astonishing. And I know people who are clever and have very witty and funny. You know, going to lunch with them is always a treat. Yeah. Now, you know, we think so much that this is the only world that exists, you know. But every once in a while, something happens to us. And it might have an odd effect, you know. It might have an odd effect. Many, many, many years ago, I was just starting graduate school at the University of Washington, and I was under a lot of stress from graduate school, and my wife and I decided to take a break and go down to Pioneer Square, go down to the Pike Place Market in Seattle, which is a big market that's right on the edge of the water. It's quite beautiful. It's up on a hill, actually, overlooking the water. And there are many levels to the market. And it was starting almost at the water level, almost down by the water, and then it's sort of like a high-rise market. We walked down the stairway from the top of the market to the foot of the market, and we went through stores, and you know, we were just relaxing and looking at, you know, things that might be in the store. Items imported from Japan, secondhand clothes. We had a meal at a restaurant in the market. We looked at a store that sold photographs, this kind of thing. We came down the stairs at the bottom of the market, and there were a group of Native American Indians performing their music and dance. And if you're familiar with that music, it's quite different from Western music, you know. They have big drums, and they beat very quickly on the drums. Like that. It's a little bit like Chinese, like Northern Chinese music. And then basically you have two or three different groups of singers, and they... sort of like that. You know? And then you have like a high voices and low voices, you know, and they're in counterpoint. And it's, I mean, if you know this music, I'm probably embarrassing you, you know, because I'm doing such a bad job of representing it. But it's quite different from Western music. And actually very haunting, you know, very, very beautiful. And anyway, I was coming down the stairs from the market, and I stopped and watched this performance. And as I was watching it, something just came over me, and I was incredibly moved. You know, moved is it's kind of a vague word, right? But all of a sudden, there were like tears coming down my face, you know, just like crying. And I had been under a lot of stress, you know, but I wasn't really sure why I was crying, you know, and I wasn't having a nervous breakdown or something. It was just quite astonishing in some way, and I couldn't tell you why. You know, the music was strange. And, you know, but it was very powerful. It was like something reached down into me and something came out that I didn't know was there, you know? And, you know, that happens to people, you know, sometimes, right? It's like you realize there are depths to yourself that we aren't normally aware of when we're just in that little circle of consciousness, you know. And something spoke to me on this very deep level, and all of a sudden I was weeping, and I was very, my emotions were like confused, you know. It was like something was trying to come out, and I wasn't sure what it was, and I couldn't figure it out, you know. This is like a little glimpse of a deeper, it's like a deeper self, right? I remember another time when I was also very stressed, and we decided to go to the zoo. The Seattle has a pretty decent zoo. And we went to the zoo, and by the way, in those days when I was a graduate student, I had so little money, it was amazing. I was just constantly broke. And we decided to go to the zoo, and the admission fee was more than we thought. So we sneaked around to the back of the zoo and climbed under the fence. Really, I really did that. I did that a number of times. Not just at the zoo, too. No. Well, my wife didn't want to do it, you know, she felt like a criminal, but it's like, come on, you know. So anyway, we sneaked under the fence, and we went to the zoo, and we were walking through the zoo, and, you know, we were sort of walking along the path, and all of a sudden I heard lions roaring, and it was just so, it was like it went right through me, you know, and it was like a wind had blown through my body, and all my problems dropped away. And I felt so liberated, you know. And you think, why? Why is this happening, you know? And, you know, the truth is I didn't really realize that I was carrying a heavy weight, you know, until the lion's roar went through me like a wind, and then I felt free. We modern people live so much on the surface of the mind, and we live in a way kind of like a very, very ignorant lives, you know, because we aren't the depths of our awareness, the depths of ourself are sort of like invisible to us, because we don't know how to look. You know, this is what Zen is, one way to understand Zen is getting in touch with the deeper mind, deeper awareness. Those parts that the conscious mind doesn't see. I was reading in the Rutgers magazine the story of this guy. His name is Ray Chambers. He's a Rutgers alumnus, and he actually grew up in Newark in the 50s. And his parents didn't have a lot of money. He lived in an apartment, and he went to business school and had to work at a job. He had a difficult time getting through school, and he got a Rutgers business degree, and then he got another degree at Seton Hall. And anyway, he was involved in the stock market, and eventually he made. By 1988, he was worth about $200 million. So this is like an American success story, right? This is like a kid from a modest home who puts himself through Rutgers, and he gets in on the ground floor of a stock market revolution, and he creates a firm that makes, you know, astronomical amounts of money. The interesting thing was, he said, he had all this money. He had a beautiful house in the suburbs. He was named by a Forbes magazine as one of the richest men in the country. He said he seemed to have it all. A beautiful wife, three children living in the suburbs. Yet, you know, he was very unhappy. And now, I myself have to tell you, I don't have $200 million. So this makes me happy in a certain way, right? It's like, oh, well, good, I'm glad, you know? Because if I had it, I'd probably be unhappy anyway. So when we hear a story like this, it's comforting if we don't have $200 million. But I think the deeper meaning of the story is that this guy was going through life doing what made sense in a certain way, you know. He was doing what our culture says you should do, which is become rich. You know, basically the message in our culture is become rich. And the other message is, if you're not rich, you're going to be really suffering. You know, and that's true. You know, my next door neighbors are losing their house because of their financial problems, John and Patrick. My friend John was a real estate agent in New York, and he was making a lot of money until the market crashed, and now he can't make his house payments. You know. So if you don't have money, there's a lot of suffering. It can entail a lot of suffering. And if you have money, it seems to bring a lot of pleasure and freedom. So this is the message our culture sends people, right? So this guy was doing seems rational, you know. He was pursuing his personal advantage, and he was creative, and he worked tremendously hard. And yet at the end of it all, he was quite unhappy. And I think this is quite typical, you know. I was listening to a writer, Jonathan Franzen, who was on the radio, and his new book has just come out, and it's shot to the top of the bestseller list. And again, you know, Franzen is somebody who people, if I'm not a creative writer, I don't write fiction, but if I did, you know, I would be jealous of Jonathan Franzen, because he's just got it, he's at the top of the world when it comes to fiction in the United States. You know, you might have written 10 books and not gotten where he is, you know, and he's written a couple books, 3 or 4, and he's at the top of his game. Everything has lined up for him. And yet, you know, he was talking to the interviewer about his struggles with depression. And you might think, well, wait a minute. You know, you're on the bestseller, you're the top of the bestseller list this week. How can you be depressed? But he says chronic struggles with depression. So, you know, I think we are kind of ignorant because we live in this very narrow realm sort of like conscious awareness. And the deeper parts of ourselves are like invisible to us. And actually, you can't get to them with the conscious mind. You know, so one way of thinking about Zen, or one element of Zen practice, is learning how to open ourselves up to the deeper parts of ourselves. You know, as sometimes when you come in and sit down on the cushion, you might be struggling with all kinds of worries and fears, and you might not even be aware of them when you sit down on the cushion. You might just be thinking, okay, I'm going to meditate. And all of a sudden, as you sit down, you suddenly realize, oh, man, I am so worried. Or, oh, man, you know, that really hurt my feelings. Now, many people never do that, you know. It's very interesting, you know. People have these painful or difficult experiences, and most people sort of like just try to push it away. And when you sit down on the meditation cushion, sometimes you start watching your breath, and all of a sudden you realize, oh, this is really troubling me, or this really hurt my feelings, you know? And this is actually difficult, right? This is the hard part of Zen meditation. You know, as I've often said, if you could just come in, sit down on the cushion, and have a blissful experience, Zen would be a drug. It wouldn't be helping you. You know, I mean, it really, that would be a bad thing. If I could just sit down on the cushion and enter bliss, that would be bad for me. You know, sometimes you do enter bliss, but you usually have to work a little hard to get there. You have to sort of like work through these things that are under the surface that are maybe bothering you. And sometimes they're big things. You know, they're things we haven't wanted to see for a long time, maybe because they hurt us so much, or maybe because, you know, the stakes are high. Anyway, you sit down on the cushion and you watch your breath, and all of a sudden you realize, you know, my brother really hurt me. He really hurt my feelings. You know, it's 20 years later, I'm still mad at him. And, you know, you keep coming back to the breath or back to your koan. And, you know, maybe you actually feel like a pain, like the real, like pain. You know? This is very good for us, this kind of a process, you know, because, you know, we have to deal with these things that are under the surface, and they're not easy to deal with. In fact, we've worked very hard usually not to deal with them. And when we sit down on the cushion and we watch the breath and something like this bubbles up, you know, it's like, oh, I don't want to, I came to the cushion just so I wouldn't have to face something like this. No. But then you sit down on the cushion and it comes up, and you just have to keep coming back to move, back to that emptiness, or back to your breath. And little by little, you're going to work it through. The bigger the problem, the more it's going to take, more sitting it's going to take. But eventually you become clear and clean. It's like you work through this obstacle. And now your mind is clear. And usually there's like a new energy or freshness, like a freshness. It's like the freedom, right? We're carrying around a lot of obstacles, a lot of weights that we don't really see, you know? And sometimes we begin to see them, and on the cushion we can work through these problems, and it can be very difficult, you know. You can get off the cushion sometime and not feel relaxed, you know. It's like you haven't worked it through, and it might take months. You know, sometimes the big problems take a long time because we don't want to see something, you know. It could be many different things. When I was you know, sometimes we just don't want to see. There's something we just don't want to see. And this is, by the way, why we can't always answer our koans. You know, you think, why can't I answer my koan? You know, I go into deep mushin. But sometimes you're encountering something you just don't want to confront, you know, and so you can get blocked. But once you confront the inner obstacle and work it through, you're a much freer person. And it's like the energy flow is now uninterrupted. And you have a kind of a lightheartedness or a kind of joy. Yeah, that's what we mean when we talk about naturalness in Zen. You know, when we work through our obstacles and we have a kind of naturalness and ease that comes from having moved through this difficult obstacle, you know. And it's really like being liberated. So this is kind of what happens to Diamond Shu in the koan. You know, he's clinging so desperately to the Diamond Sutra. And it must be because he's afraid of something, you know. The koan doesn't tell us what, but it's like he's got his sacred teaching, you know, and it's in his hand day after day, and he's holding on to it for dear life. And he's memorizing all these lines. And there's something slightly, you know, the koan doesn't put it this way because Freud was yet to be born, you know. But there's something slightly neurotic about this, right? You know, he's really attached unhealthily to the koan. It's become like an addiction or an obsession for him. And so he's sitting on the cushion day after day, and he's not getting anywhere. He's just thinking. And so he goes in to see the teacher, and the teacher goes, "Oh, brother, here comes Tokusan." You know, Tokusan's going to go, "Why do you Zen people think you don't have to know the sutras?" You know, and then the teacher might say, "Well, you know, blah, blah, blah." And then there'll be your answer, and this goes on and on. So, "Oh, brother, here comes Tokusan." You know, and he comes in for Tokusan for the meeting with the teacher, the private meeting, and they go on and on and on and on and on and on. And finally, it's dark, you know, and Tokusan's about to leave, and he goes, "It's dark." And the teacher gets a candle and hands it to him. But then when Tokusan takes the candle, the teacher blows it, and Tokusan's mind goes blank. See? And then he becomes, he must become aware of his situation, you know. Maybe it all happens at once. We don't get all the details. But when his mind is blank, it's like he suddenly discovered there's this deep ocean, you know, a deep ocean under the surface. And it says, how does it put it in the koan? It says, he went through a deep experience, and then he made vows. So we don't really know. Maybe he stumbles into this blankness, which we call mu. If you meditate long enough, you're going to notice that there's actually a place in your mind, so to speak, that has no characteristics. It's absolutely blank. We call this mu, or emptiness. So when Buddhists talk about emptiness, it's not we're not talking about it poetically. Right, we're not talking about like the emptiness of a meaningless life or something like that. When Buddhists talk about emptiness, we're talking about real nothingness. You know, that in the mind there's a place, so to speak, where you will encounter real nothingness. And Tokusan stumbles into this, and suddenly his fear, or maybe it takes an evening. The fear that he's been clinging, that's been clinging to him, that's been making him so obsessive and attached to the Diamond Sutra, is gone. See? And the next day, he is free from this attachment, this fear. And he burns the sutras. Right? He burns the sutras. And he's actually happy about it. He burned all his notes, then making vows, he took leave of his teacher. Actually, in reality, he didn't really go. He came back and studied with Ryotan for a number of years after that. And then Tokusan became a great Zen master himself. But this is really like a deeper life. You know, if you aren't too familiar with Zen, you know, it's really about, you know, we live like on the surface of the ocean, but the life of the ocean is in the ocean. It only appears to be on the surface. Modern people live very much on the surface, you know. But underneath there are these powerful forces, you know, that are like the forces of the universe or the forces of nature. And we're ignorant of them, and we're tossed this way and that by these powerful forces, and we have no control over them because you can't get to them consciously. So Zen is all about working through encountering these obstacles and then working through them and being a free person. And it's really about freedom and living life fully. You know, when we talk about a unified mind in accord with the way, we're talking about somebody who's harmonized the conscious and the unconscious. These are like the two halves that fit together, like yin and yang, the conscious and the unconscious. And when they're in harmony, then it's a beautiful life. And when they're out of balance, then it's unhappiness. So finally, for Tokusan, they're in balance now. And he realizes, I've been clinging to the sutras because I've been afraid. And now my fear is gone, and the world is just like an open place. It's like a great journey now to me, like an open road. And I can go this way or that as I please. See, without fear. It's nice, right? So, Mumon's verse. Hearing the name cannot surpass seeing the face. Seeing the face cannot surpass hearing the name. See, the poem starts out by saying, hearing the name cannot surpass seeing the face. So in other words, I can say the word Jaru, but it's not the same as meeting Jaru face to face. Got it? So you hear me say that, and you say, oh, now I understand Zen. So saying Jaru's name is not the same as seeing Jaru face to face. You hear me say that, and you think, ah, now I understand Zen. But see, then the poem turns around and says, seeing the face cannot surpass hearing the name. So it just reverses what we just said, see. So now it says seeing Jaru's face is not as good as hearing her name. And you think, well, what is this all about? That's a contradiction. Well, the point is, you're just using your discriminating mind, the little mind we live in. There's a deeper mind which holds us in chains sometimes. But we can liberate ourselves by getting in touch with that through meditation practice, working through our obstacles. Hearing the name cannot surpass seeing the face. Seeing the face cannot surpass hearing the name. He may have lost his nose, but he may have saved his nose, but alas, he lost his eyes. This is Zen talk for everybody did a good job and is having a good time now that they're free from their obstacles, okay? So in Zen, we very seldom say things directly when we're really serious. So today, maybe you sat down on the cushion and experienced a bliss. And today, maybe you sat down on the cushion and you experienced some obstacles, right? Either way, that's really great. So please just keep practicing. You know, our natural state is really quite wonderful, and just takes a little sitting.